Andy?
Yeah.
Yo.
Hey.
Hey. We're doing it.
Finally, there's a lot of build-up to this one. A lot of
anticipation and or disappointment. I'm kidding.
I hope not, because I think that, you know, Cronus are obviously a really important band to the Northern Virginia music scene. And a lot of people have really fond memories of your show.
Oh, that's cool. It's bizarre to think about that Cronus started 25 years ago.
Yeah.
This year.
It's crazy how much time has actually gone on. This podcast actually sort of started, or part of the starting of this podcast, was a poster that came out celebrating the 30th anniversary of Jam for Man.
Wait.
It's the 30th anniversary of Jam for Man this year. The first year of Jam's for Man.
Wait.
Just curious, did you get a chance to attend any of the Jam for Man shows?
No. Like, I moved here, when I mean here, I moved from Florida to Fairfax in 1991, like, right before the Rodney King riots. And so it took me a while to kind of, I mean, relatively speaking, it wasn't a while, but it took me a while to kind of dial in to the local scene. And, you know, I went to Robinson High School, and out of everyone from Robinson, there was like one other kid that liked the same exact kind of music that I liked, you know, like that was really into hardcore. And it was just kind of weird.
Well, then you were missing out, not moving to Reston.
Yeah, I know, right?
Because there was a whole hardcore scene going on in Reston at that time. Or, it was definitely waning by the early 90s. But certainly, you know, from about 86 to 90 was the heyday of the Reston hardcore scene.
Right. And, like, for me, it was, you know, part of, you know, I moved in the middle of 10th grade, which is an extremely difficult year when you're trying to kind of figure out who you are in life. And the way that it was in Florida, the schools were not set up the same. So I did not have junior high. I had middle school, which was 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, and then high school was 10th, 11th, 12th. So I only had actually been in high school for a couple months, and then I moved to Robinson, which was like 5,000 people or something like that. It was just insane being around so many people and, you know, not really knowing. Yeah, you, like, when you move, your infrastructure's gone, and then let alone, like, the only real way to connect is, like, to the music that I was interested in was just searching out the record stores, and that kind of, you know, one thing led to another.
What brought your parents to the area? What made them want to move from Florida to the D.C. suburbs?
My father is a minister. He's a Southern Baptist minister, and he was approached. He was approached in Florida to come and take over a church in Annandale, actually. And so, like, we came up and visited in the fall of 1990, and I met everyone at this church. It was Parkwood Baptist Church at the intersection of Rolling Road and Braddock Road. And, you know, there's so many different schools here, and so many different kids from so many different schools. Like, I just went and toured all these different schools. you know, Robinson, Woodson, Lake Braddock, you know, all these different places. And then, you know, when we ended up moving here, it was kind of on me to figure out which school I was kind of leaning towards. And I liked Robinson the best.
Why?
Because this super cute girl from my youth group church, that's where she attended. She went to Robinson, and I was like, I also need to go to Robinson.
I guess that's as good a reason as any.
You know, like, if you have your choice, that was my choice. And the irony is, she and I never dated. It was just, she was my, you know.
Crush.
She was my crush. I mean, we're friends. I mean, we're still friends to this day, but we just never. She was one of those girls that always had, like, this one boyfriend for years. Yeah, like, there's, like one or two girls in school that just are constantly in a relationship with some guy from somewhere else. Like, he didn't go to our school, he didn't go to our church, just some other dude, and that was her.
Yeah, you didn't have a prayer there.
Yeah, living on a prayer, dude.
So, when you were in Florida and you were listening to hardcore music, were you familiar with the DC scene?
Dude, are you kidding? Yeah, 100%. I was so freaking psyched. Like, so right before we moved, you know, we had, you know, my mom, or specifically my mom, had this talk. Because I lived in a very small beach town in Florida. It was called Satellite Beach, where, like, we could ride our bikes to school, and there was a strip mall that we could ride to. Like, everything was pretty close. But if you wanted to go to the place to get hardcore, that was on mainland, and that was a drive. You know, my parents had to drive, or a friend, you know, an older friend or something. And so my mom was like, you know, when we move up to Washington, D.C., everything's really far apart. We're going to have to drive everywhere. It's just, we're not going to be able to really, things are going to be really, really different. You know, was kind of what I was led to believe. And then she was like, we're actually moving to Fairfax County. And I was like, holy crap, that is mentioned on the Scream LP. Like, one of the like shout outs on the Scream LP, the guy was like, yo, it's the Fairfax County Police. He's like, dude, that's where I'm moving. I called all my friends, like, dude, put on the Scream LP. They yell Fairfax County, that's where I'm moving. I'm like, I thought you were going to D.C. It's like, I think I am, but I think that's actually where I'm going. It was like this, like, definitive moment. I was like, oh, dude, Scream is close to where I'm from. You know, like, this, it was pretty pinnacle, but I was way into Minor Threat. You know, a lot of their, I'm not going to say a lot of the early Discord stuff. Minor Threat, period. You know, like, I remember the day that our school found out about Fugazi. This like, older skater dude, he looked like Anthony Kiedis from Red Hot Chili Peppers. His name was Tony. He had long hair and a shirt. He was skating inside the school against the rules. He's like, dude, you guys hear this new Minor Threat band? I'm like, there's a new Minor Threat band? This is like 1989. Like, this is far beyond Minor Threat. And Fugazi had already been around for a while. I'm like, dude, Fugazi, check it out. And I heard it, and I was like, I hate this. This does not sound like Minor Threat or Scream. What is this? He's like, dude, it's so much better. He's like, you are wrong. And I was a super judgmental eighth grader that loved Sepultura and Creator, like, you know, thrash metal. And so kind of coming out of that mindset of being like, if you sang, I didn't like it. It was a guitar solo, I didn't like it. It had to be fast, it had to be loud, and it had to be angry. And then moving to D.C., moving and starting to attend shows in D.C. and kind of discovering that there are all these scenes that are not the same. Because, in Florida, if you listen to the Misfits, you listen to Minor Threat, you listen to Fugazi, maybe you listen to, like, Dinosaur Jr. or something like that, but you listen to Op Ivy and you could be straight edge, all this different stuff. And then coming up here and the scenes were totally split apart, it was really shocking to me to be like, oh, this is not all the same. It's different. And that was kind of my foray into all the different scenes. And it's actually a pretty interesting, I've never thought about it till right now, kind of precursor to the way Frotis operated. Because we didn't relegate ourselves to one specific show, like type of show. We played all kinds of stuff everywhere.
Well, I think that that's true for all of the bands from Northern Virginia. All
right.
All of the bands that I have, that I've loved over the years and that I've talked to and interviewed, they all have very different sounds, and then there are certain themes that run, I think, more through the ideology of the band than anything else.
Well, I think too, it's like you like living in the shadow of Discord. Not living. I mean, part of it is like living in the shadow of Discord. It has to be influential. And for the most part, it's usually positive. Sometimes it can be super negative. Like, I remember, we are from Northern Virginia. We don't live in D.C., So it's like there's this feeling of being an outsider that most of the time it's fabricated. Like, it's self-doubt, or not self-doubt. It's like being self-conscious with yourself about not living inside the district border, I'm not really a part of the scene. I just live next to it, And then one of the things for me that's been so interesting, 25 years later is to hear people speak that way to me about my old band. Like, we weren't really from D.C. like you guys. I was like, what are you talking about? I was like, Yes, now I live inside of Washington, D.C. And yes, Frotis did practice in Washington, D.C. for a long time. But whether or not we lived in Fairfax County and played in Washington, D.C., none of it matters. Do you know what I mean? None of that matters. But, for the – maybe it's ego. Maybe it's want of inclusion. Like, everyone always wants to be like, oh, we're from D.C., but then, stepping back, none of it doesn't matter at all where you're from. It's like, where you perform. And at the end, when bands get really active, people are like, oh, well, how often do you play home? Like, we play in D.C. once a year. We play D.C. just as much as we play Los Angeles or whatever, things evolve.
And most of the guys from those bands weren't from D.C. anyway.
right, exactly.
All the bands that people think of as D.C. bands, they're from different, suburbs and places around D.C. for the most part.
Right. And again, it's like, I think part of it is just like playing music, being... Yeah, it is super intimidating to be in a band and then, who's your local band? It's Fugazi and Jawbox. I've heard of them. You know what I mean? You're kind of forced into the shadow of these living legends, essentially. And it can go one of two ways. You can either kind of, it makes you, kind of craft your own identity, or you fall into being, you kind of playing into trying to be assimilated by a group. And one of the things that, you know, it took me a long time. It's like, it's not like these are like, because, I mean, you know, back in the day, DC had this, like, legendary, infamous reputation of being totally snotty and you know, not caring and being really, really pretentious and everything else. And, like, getting older as an adult, I don't think that was the case at all. I think DC, the DC music scene was mostly made of incredibly introverted individuals. You know? Like,
and people who were very, you know, I mean, they're very inclusive or wanted to include, like, the kids and create an atmosphere that was accepting of all kinds of different people and, you know, doing stuff that was socially conscious, too.
Yeah. Agreed.
And so, I think in a lot of respects, those bands changed the reputation of DC.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, too, it's like once, it's weird. I've been reading the, I don't know if it's considered the oral history, but basically the history of Straight Edge. It's actually a really, really interesting book in about, like, the development of the movement and of the subculture and all of that. And, it starts here. It takes place here. And it's really interesting because all of these bands, all these Straight Edge bands are so iconic. And, I was in a Straight Edge band. I was in Battery, and we were on Revelation Records, and we're a part of that scene. But yet, there's these other bands that I have no interaction with, like SSD Control from Boston. Like, they're basically attributed to, like, spreading the movement, and, like, Minor Threat kind of started it, you know? And it's like, to hear all of those guys, not specifically SSD, but, like, to hear these iconic bands that I've grown up listening to basically say the same exact thing of, like, yeah, we kind of felt like outsiders and we, did our own thing. And I was like, dude, I think that's part, like, that drive is what universally pushes bands to become who they are.
And,
you know?
Well, to play music.
Yeah, to play music, but to kind of find their identity inside of the collection that is their band, you know? Like, I find that stuff really interesting.
Well, so when you were in high school, did you have other bands?
No, well, I mean, in Florida, I was in a hardcore band. And it was comedically called Headlock. I still have the demo tape, and it sounds pretty legit for being 15 years old, but when I moved here, like I was saying before, I was trying to be in a hardcore band, and there wasn't anyone at my school, and the very first person I ever played music with is Amy Deal, who's now the bass player for Darkest Hour, but back then, he was just like an alternative guy. So he shows up, he's got on art, like, overalls, and he's talking to me about Dinosaur Jr. And I was like, dude, what is Dinosaur Jr.? That band sounds terrible. And again, you know, it's like my ear was not developed at this stage for that music. And so I just quit playing drums when I moved up here. And then stumbled into meeting the other guy that ended up becoming Frotis. So Frotis was like my first band in high school when I was here.
And so, and how did you and Shelby meet?
Dude, this is really entertaining. So I moved to DC. My mom gets a part-time job, right? She's working for like the media duplication house for Fairfax County, meaning whatever, your high school, Reston High School, needs a bunch of videos of some math tutorial for their classes. They put an order in, and then they dial up and fabricate like 5 more videotapes to send to Reston. And my mom worked in that office, right? Just totally random. My mom's a trained social worker, and she was kind of over the social working world. And there was this older guy that was probably a junior in college that was working with my mom. My mom was always like, oh, you need to meet Dan. Dan sounds like someone right up your alley. He's like, yeah, but does Dan like sheer terror? Does Dan like Youth of Today? Who is this guy? And so I end up going with my church to some youth group thing. What was it called? I don't remember what it was called, but it was in Ocean City, Maryland. And there was like a band, quote unquote, that was playing at this event. And I ended up like kind of hanging out with them after one of like the Bible study things. And it was Shelby. And this guy, there was another guy in the band named Dan, and I was like, oh, where are you guys from? Like, oh, you know, from Fairfax. I was like, you what? And this dude, Dan, was the guy my mom had been trying to introduce me to. He just happened to be at the same thing. And then Shelby was really, it was like, you know, early Nirvana. This is 1993. And so, you know, Shelby had on a cardigan and like a Curious George shirt and like beads and long hair. This was like a, you know, grunge rock dude. But he had this list. We started hanging out. He had this list of records he wanted to buy. And one of them was like Biohazard, Urban Discipline. And I thought that was so amazing. And then they ended up needing a drummer. And so I was going to, this is all true. And this is how the formation of Frotis happened. I had, like I said before, I had quit playing drums, and my car got hit and run, and I got all this insurance money, but my car drove fine. So I was like, oh, maybe I'll buy a new drum set. And my friend was going to sell me the larger half of like this huge 9-piece heavy metal drum set, right? So I had read in Modern Drummer magazine that to see if you're as good as a player, you have to videotape yourself. And so we couldn't find time for me to try out with this band that Shelby was doing. And so I had this random-ass videotape of me playing the song Arise, Shirtless by Sepultura, and I just sent them the videotape. They were like,
they were like,
yeah, remember that guy we met at that like youth trip thing? He just sent us a video of him shirtless playing a Sepultura song, I think he should be in the band. And then, you know, and then that's, I mean, that's how it started. That was spring of 1993.
And so, where did you guys go from there? At that point,
like, it was, you know, they had played a couple shows. It was not called Frotus. That band was called Limb Chip. And then what ended up happening was one guy in the band lived in Rockville, Maryland, and was older. And then there was the guitarist, Dan, who was older. And then Shelby and I were the same age. So we were the youngest. And then we started just, like, stupid high school bickering inside of band practice. You know, like, Dan wanted to take the band one direction, and we were just like, we don't want to do that, you know? And he ended up one day, like, getting really angry and leaving band practice. And then the three of us were by ourselves. And Jim had driven all the way to parents' house from Rockville. And no joke, we wrote the first six Frodo songs in, like, an hour and a half. And that was our first 8th and 7-inch. Boom. Like, we practiced six times. We were going to do a show. Jim was going away to college, and we set up this huge, which is a whole other crazy adventure. We set up this kind of show under false pretenses at West Springfield High School. And right before we played, someone pulled the fire alarm. Mm. We never got to play. And so.
That sucks.
Yeah, it totally sucks. But this is how the band actually started. So what happened was we had these six songs, and then that was it. The band was over. And so one of Shelby's older brother's friends was like, hey, you guys should go record your set. And we're like, what do you mean? But you should go to a recording studio and document this. And we thought it was insane. She's like, you should go to WGNS Studios, which was Jeff Turner from Gray Matter and Charles Dennington from the High Back Chairs. And we're like, okay, sure. So we went and just recorded our set list. And then Jeff and Charles were the ones that were like, what are you guys going to do with this recording? We're like, nothing. We were supposed to play at Shelby's High School, and someone pulled a fire alarm, so we just wanted to record the songs that we wrote before Jim goes away to college. And they're like, you should put this out. I was like, what do you mean? Like, you should make this on a record. I was like, what? I was like, oh, my God, the guy from Gray Matter thinks we should make a record. This is amazing. And then, you know, it just kind of changed my mental state. And then we're like, okay, maybe we will be a band. And then we have to find a bass player. And everything's just – and that's basically how it started.
Well, isn't that also the story of the band? We have to find a bass player?
Yes. And then that moment defined the rest of my professional life. Up until to this very day. For some reason, I always have issues with bass players.
You're not fun, man.
All right, good.
That happens to the best of us. And then, you know, some of us wind up playing bass because we can't find a bass player. You know, it's like, screw it.
The last incarnation of Furnace, that was like the last couple years, that's exactly what happened. Like, Nathan Burke, who was in the band Real Cool Rain, who's like way more pro than we were at the time, we tried to get him in the band in 94, and he was going away to college again in Scotland or something. And then he came home, and they're like, hey, you know, we just came back from our first European tour, and we really need a bass player. Like, do you want to try again? Like, you're home. Why not? And he was like, okay, let's do it. And that, you know, that was the last bass player of Frotus, officially. But including all that, it was 11 people.
When you guys recorded that first demo,
yeah,
I mean, I know Jim was going away, but, I mean, was there a thought that you and Shelby, like, that there was something really good there that, you know...
Well, Jim, I mean, Jim was kind of the linchpin, to be honest. Like, I mean, he was in, like, I think he was in, like, a Simpson. He is an unbelievably professional musician, you know? And we were like, okay, like, the three of us just wrote all these songs without, you know, it just happened, like, really quick. And so the idea of us doing that without Jim getting into our heads, you know, and just, hey, you should do this. And then we wrote the song, like, off of the Molotov Cocktail Party, our first record or tape or whatever you want to call it, had the song Business Creep on it, but we actually recorded a version of it for the 7-inch at WGNS. And so when they kind of convinced us, Shelby and I were like, oh, we actually have a song that we didn't really do a good version of. Like, maybe we could write some more stuff. And then decided to kind of keep it going and have a friend of ours named Kyle come and play with us. And, you know, just that's how it kind of, it went from being like, oh, here's a 7-inch or here's a tape, to maybe we could actually write more songs. And then the same thing happened. Like, Jim came home for winter break. I think we practiced, like, maybe 6 or 7 times, then wrote all of Molotov Cocktail Party and went and recorded that.
And what were, like, what was the big song for you guys during that time? Like, what
was... Oh, dude, 100% Sasquatch. It was... a completely satirical song written about a Sasquatch shopping at a mall. And, I mean, to this day, you know, people are like, dude, Sasquatch, man, that was awesome. But did you get into the later material that was a little bit more serious?
Sasquatch, gonna be a big beast, no man, gonna go and stop the hunt. Ooh, little Sasquatch, why do you frolic so far? You're running away. You're running away!
In terms of Shelby, like, as a lyricist and singer back then, I mean, what was your sort of take on what he was doing?
Well, I mean, we were, you know, like, dude, I incessantly joke around, like, all the time. You know, I am 42 years old. Like, imagine me at 17, no filter. No understanding of toning it down. And so the music essentially was all, like, I'm not a lyric guy. Meaning, unless it was, like, blatant Satanism and I felt that, like, was against my moral upbringing, I didn't care what anyone was saying, you know?
But Sepultura was fine.
mean, they're mostly just like death lyrics, but like Morbid Angel was straight up, or like Deicide, that are just like about Satanism, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that was like me being rebellious inside the confines of like, my parents were not strict, but like a very conservative Southern Baptist upbringing, you know?
Well, yeah. How did your dad react to what you were doing?
Well, I mean, like, I wanted to play drums my whole life, you know? And, you know, I got a drum set when I was in sixth grade or something. And then, you know, then we moved up here and I started playing music. And, you know, even if you don't like the music, there's no denying that it was like, it wasn't just like us in the garage doing something that sounded kind of bad. Like, Jim was in an orchestra and we could literally, you know, be like, was just an amazing bass player and brought that. And then we would practice at my parents' house. It was like, there was obviously tension when decision time came between higher education or being in a band. And, you know, I went to NOVA to basically stay, you know, Northern Virginia Community College to stay on my mom's or my parents' insurance. But then the second semester of college, you know, I booked Protus every weekend shows all up and down the East Coast. And it was ridiculous. You know, we'd drive, you know, 8.5 hours to play some show in the middle of nowhere in Connecticut for like $50 to then turn around and come home. You know, but every weekend. And then, you know, I had to teach myself how to book these tours. And so, you know, Discord was really amazing and would give you a list. But I booked a really solid 10-day tour for us in 1995. And since I couldn't fill one date, I only had 9 shows, I canceled the whole thing because I thought I had failed. And they were like legit shows too. And so, you know, and then, you know, things kind of progressed. And then I learned, like, no, like, 9 shows in 2 days are actually good. And just because you don't have one doesn't mean that you failed as a booking agent. You know?
Well, considering the fact that you were willing to drive all the way to Connecticut for one show,
But that was the plan. It was like, okay, we've got this one show. It's Frotus and the Crown Hate Ruin in this band Cable in this place called Studio 138, Studio something. And to this day, there's like, you know, I met a handful of people at that show, but I still know. And that's the thing that I've always kind of has been amazing to me, like this many years later. You know, the people that you meet during those times are, you know, they're still in music. They'll run into people, and people are still around.
Well, in terms of the shows that you played in the Northern Virginia area, and with and with other, like, Northern Virginia bands, what were the places that you remember playing in?
Oh, there was only one place, dude. One place, the music store, out in Chantilly. You know, like, if you interview Bubble Jug, like, I mean, that was our spot. It was, you know, it was like this weird guitar store run by, like, a, like, Manassas guy that was always in overalls and named Johnny Ray and just would let whatever happen there. He was always hammered. But we did so many shows there.
So what was it like playing there? Like, what was the sound like? What was the crowd like?
I mean, it was, you know, basically a box. It was just a box, and like, you know, you don't think about it when it's happening, but there'd be a ton of kids at those shows. 200, 300 kids most of the time. you know? Like, it was kind of cavernous, but that was, like, the scene. And people would come and hang out. People would be hanging out outside, and people would be inside. And Johnny Ray was there. Like, you couldn't tell if he was, like, you just assumed he was drunk. But he wasn't belligerent. And I couldn't even tell you. Like, I think the bubble jug people are the ones that got that showcase. From my recollection, but I really don't remember.
Yeah. I think that they said that they were sort of amazed when they stumbled upon it.
Like, yeah, like it was like this weird warehouse on Sullyfield Circle, right by Dulles Airport.
Maybe looking at instruments, and there was, like, nothing there, but then they saw the back room, and they were just, like, asking him about what, you know, could they play there?
And he was,
yeah, I guess.
Sure. Why not? Go for it. And so it was, actually, not just there. I mean, Jason Yawn, from, you know, back then, he was in Turbine. We used to do shows at his dad's church in Annandale, First Baptist Church in Annandale. And we did some really big shows there, which was wild. Like, it was like Frodis, it was the very, very first Darkest Hour show. Like, maybe Jarhead, which was like a couple of local bands, but there was like almost 800 people at that show. It's insane. You know? Like, this is probably like 96?
Yeah. I'm happy when I get, like, you know, 20, 25 people out at my shows. Like, imagining being a kid in high school or whatever and 800 people, 800 kids show up to my show. That'd be nuts.
Yeah. It's totally insane. I mean, you know, and things changed, you know, like almost no one gets that many people out now, you know, but like, yeah, I mean, it was pretty, you know, thinking about it in retrospect and then comparatively to now, like going to shows now or being in a band and playing shows now, like, yeah, I mean, up to 50 people are around, let alone 700, you know?
And what were you guys doing? Like, how were you going about promoting your shows,
Flyers. Just flyers. Man, flyers, like, Shelby and I would go out all the time. We'd pass flyers out everywhere. We'd put posters up everywhere. We would, so, I mean, socially, you know, we would just go out all the time, you know? And it was, you know, looking back, it's all really interesting. Like, in the grand scheme of, what, you know, like the arc of DC music, you know, Frodo started in 93, but really started to play out in 94. And that's the era of when Shudder to Think and Jawbox are on their major labels. And Fugazi's, like, at their crowning hugeness. And, you know, I'm super persistent, and I would just call the Black Cat all the time for us to play, all the time. And at that point, Chris Thompson was the booking intern, which I thought was, like, the coolest thing ever. It's like, dude, the guy from Circus Lupus called me. He answered the phone at the Black Cat. It's amazing, you know?
Yeah.
And then when these people started to hear about size of the Frodo shows in Northern Virginia, then they started to give us shows, you know? And so, and that's kind of how things kind of transferred from being, like, just in Northern Virginia out into the world. But a lot of it was just, like, me, like, persisting, like, just calling all the time. And, you know, like, some people would probably call it annoying, but you know, it wasn't me, like, pulling on someone's shirt coattails, like, hey, you know, we've got these shows around town. Could we do one at the Black Cat? And then they agreed. And then, you know, people came. And it just kind of kept escalating.
Did you play since the old 930?
Yeah, we did actually. We that was one of my favorite BC shows of all time. It was on the, because remember they had a downstairs too. On the top, like main stage, it was Frotis, Pitchblend, and Candy Machine from Baltimore. And then downstairs with the band Branch Manager that had just signed the Discord. And, and you know, we were on the main stage, and I don't even think we played first. I think we played second or something. I don't quote me on that. I was really nervous because I was like, dude, like this is the 930 club. This is crazy. And I remember looking, like opening the door and looking out to see if anyone was there, and there was a line down the sidewalk. Not a big one, but there was a lot. There was enough people to make a line. And I thought that was like the craziest, most amazing thing ever. And that show was really, really, it was a great show. Totally packed out. There's tons of people at the 930 Club. And it kind of felt like, because all those guys are older, you know, like we got a chance. You know, we were younger kids and we got a chance and was given a chance and pulled it off however you want to describe it. But so you know, we didn't play into the like DC space or any of these other kind of legendary places, you know, but we did get to play the old 930 Club. I tried to get us to play at the Black Cat next week, but Dante called me to see if Rodas would play at the 25th anniversary of the Black Cat, and we were really trying to make it happen, but with Shelby in Sweden and Nathan in Seattle in life, we just could not pull it off.
So you guys are, you and Shelby are definitely still in touch and on good terms.
Yeah, I mean, like, for the most part, it's like we don't talk all the time. And we're on pretty good terms, but it's not like, we don't live next to each other and we don't play music with each other. And we're not like super tight like we used to be. But there's no like bad blood or anything like that. It's just like life and circumstance, essentially.
And you're definitely like open, like you said, to if he was in the States and there was something, you know.
Yeah, and like we did play some shows 9 years ago, and that was awesome. You know, it was really fun, and I think that kind of satisfies that era for Shelby. Unfortunately, we did not do it with Nathan, and I wish that Frodis could play one last show with Nathan. I think that would be incredible, but I don't know if that would ever happen at this point in life.
Well, so long as you guys are still alive, it can still happen.
Right.
Yeah, there's always a chance.
Yeah.
So what was the peak of the band after that? And what was, you know, sort of like, how did the band come to a close?
Well, in like spring of 95, that is when we really started to do it. Like, okay, we are going to tour. Like, it is happening. And then fall of 95 is when I got asked to join Battery, which had just made the decision to really be an active band as well.
To the top.
And so I would say the peak era of Froedus was probably 97 and 98. And that is after, you know, we did our first record, F Letter, and that's when we started to kind of go out and tour. But then when we wrote and toured on Conglomerate International was when I would definitely call that like the height of, you know. We toured the most in 1998, and that's when, you know, we had this, like, world tour plan with Refused, and we toured Scandinavia with them, and then we brought them here, and they broke up, and then, you know, our band broke up, you know.
And you were playing in both bands at that time?
I was playing in Battery and Froedus simultaneously, yeah. So, I would, you know, Battery would go on tour, then I would come home, and then Froedus would go on tour, and then first to write a record, and then Daddy would write a record.
How did you physically pull that off?
Well, I don't know. I'm an enthusiastic man. I mean, we didn't tour together. Like, it wasn't like... There was only one time where Froedus and Battery did three overlapping shows. And that was actually in Scandinavia with Refused. And then we did one show at First Baptist Annandale, actually, where I played two sets. And we had, like, time off so I could have some active recovery in between sets.
That sounds very physically and mentally draining.
I mean, I think it was, but, you know, that's the point for me. You know,
yeah.
Like,
you were young. You didn't know anything.
Well, I mean, I still operate the same, where it's like, how do we push the envelope exact? You know, like, that was kind of the impetus for the band, was how do we explore and play music at the same time? And that's how I started to kind of book tours. Like, it's the adventure of, like, dude, let's go for 3 months straight. You know, like, let's go, like, you know, most people, if they play three, and they play, like, three shows, we play 27 shows in different towns, in 27 different places. You know, with Refused, with, like, the biggest hardcore band from Sweden. And it was
I said, you played so much, Shelby decided to stay.
Exactly. Like, we would, like, Froedus, like, most people would fly into Germany for their tours, but we would fly into Sweden. And I'd say, we did it twice. Like, we did two European tours, you know? And then it kept, you know, then you do a European tour, and then, you know, then the goal changes to something else. Like, oh, we did Europe, you know, next is Japan, next. Then when we broke up, I was trying to book it in Antarctica. For real, you know?
That's
like.
Is that possible?
Well, do you remember DSI Records, John Fox, season band United Mutation? They're like Arlington band. His brother is a scientist in Antarctica, and he did like a collection of local music at one point. And so I was like, well, they got our CD in some like scientist station, and since we were so like into science and all that stuff, like lyrically with the band, like that'd be incredible if we would just play to some like science station.
Yeah, no, it fits for sure. It totally
and
seems
so,
like something you guys would do.
And it was just kind of like, it didn't matter. It was like, it would be amazing if we did that and there was like 20 scientists and we were just like in some weird bunker somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know, with some new,
like fuck Pink Floyd at Pompeii.
Here's Froedus at a science research facility at the bottom of the world. Thank you all 15 of you for coming out.
So speaking of like Froedus in terms of as idea or a movement or what you guys were kind of trying to, I don't even know what to say, like represent or be or accomplish with the band. Maybe you can sort of explain that, because I'm fumbling with it.
Well, I mean, there was not some unified front on what, you know, what was the goal or what was the point or anything like that. Like, it was a pretty supportive environment, you know? Like, Shelby has a really specific way of playing guitar, and I have, a pretty specific way of playing drums, and it works between the two of us. And then you add a third member, and that's where it gets kind of hard, because it's like...
Well, no, I mean the subversive messages of...
That is where the third member comes in, you know? Like, and so over the course of time, we had these the kind of submersive message that originally started was definitely Shelby and Jim. You know, mostly Jim, and then Shelby got on board, you know? And then things just kind of kept elevating, and it was just, you know, part of it was real. Like, you know, we did kind of fuel into conspiracy theories, and Shelby was heavily involved in, like, the underground computer world and hacking, and it was, like, this whole scenario, like, these group of people that would meet in Pentagon City that were kind of hackers that we used to go to. I don't remember much about it other than it was just not my scene. But I was there regardless, you know? And then it just kind of kept evolving. On the first 7-inch we did with Howard Pyle as our bass player, this is kind of when it became pretty full time. Like, that was a 7-inch on Love It Records, and then Shoot Records, which was John Davis from Korn and Cuban Not You. We developed this thing called SL, Frota Sound Laboratories, and it's like this whole kind of manifesto about sound and being a laboratory, and we always had this kind of like science edge to it. Part, it was just like a fun alter reality, and then part of it was also fueled with, you know, by curiosity and then some, you know, theories and things like that. And then as the band kind of matured, then so did lyrics and interests and everything else. It's kind of this unified theme of, you know, what else is happening, and I think came to its head with the Conglomerate International record. And like most of that, like I was along for the ride for a lot of that stuff. And then I would agree or disagree, but almost never disagree. Like if the guy's cool, it's fine. You know?
Yeah. Well, it seems like, you know, for a lot of it, it's sort of a goof for you, you know, it's part of like the fun of joking around and kind of fucking with people's minds.
Yeah, totally. you know, like we, I mean, and that's the thing too, like, you know, like, and that's what I think is kind of the hallmark of being in a supportive band. It's like, you know, I learned so much from Shelby, so much music, like stuff that I never, ever, ever would have given a chance. I learned from him. I listened to this day. Martin Denny is one of them. the kind of like lounge guy. Like, I love that stuff, you know? And then I would hope or think that I did things that rubbed off on all of the other guys too. And like, we really, you know, learned from each other and grew as a unit until it, you know, just like with any relationship, if you don't have the tools to maintain, to express, then things can fall apart. And that, you know, definitely happened at the end where we just toured all the time and things just started to wear each other, you know?
When you were working on the last album, did you know that was going to be it?
No, like, there was some pretty serious tragedy around that last record. Like, my girlfriend that I've been dating for several years, she came down with terminal cancer. This is all in 1 week. This is June of 1999. Alana, my girlfriend, got diagnosed with, like, absolutely no way to get better, like, full-blown terminal cancer. 3 days later, Shelby's dad got a car wreck and went half-paralyzed. And then Nathan was in, visiting a friend over in Glasgow where he went to college, visiting his girlfriend and finds out his girlfriend's cheating on him with someone else. So he gets over there, he's out of a relationship, calls, upset. It's like, well, Alana's fucking dying and Shelby's dad can't move anymore. It's like, and that set the tone for us recording the record and writing it. We wrote a bunch of songs after hearing all that.
Well, so there's a lot of dealing with grief.
Yeah, there's like a lot of grief on there. And you know, what pretty much led to the band's demise was Nathan Shelby wanted me to like focus, not what led to the demise, but what like ended it, what like actually stopped the band, was they felt that like, I was going to be concentrating too much on band stuff as opposed to really dealing with my girlfriend, and which was inaccurate. And it was just, you know, a lot of times it's easier to just stop than it is to, like, try to sort it out. And so that's what ended up happening. They basically decided in December of 99 that it was, like, everything was just too much. They've had enough, and the band was going to be done. And I didn't really have any say in it.
But they were trying to support you in a way, I guess.
I mean, theoretically, you know, like, and that's where, and, you know, that's kind of where it comes in, where it's like, yeah, it was voiced as such, but, you know, obviously other things leading to those decisions.
Is it hard for you to listen to that music even today?
It's not hard. It's, you know, it's kind of a listening test. I'm proud of that record. I'm glad we wrote those songs. You know, like it served a time in the. When I say it served a time and a place, I mean that, like, that is the sound of us transitioning out of, like, full-blown silliness and just dealing with, like, being adults. And it sucked. You know? Like, it was really hard. And, like, I go to chemotherapy sessions and I show up to mint. You know? And so it was just, you know, it's difficult. Thank you. there's one song on that record about that month called 699, about June of 1999. And that can be hard to listen to, depending on my mood.
And so, how long was it before you were, you know, ready to start playing again with other people and join us?
Well, I mean, so, I mean, we had become friends with a bunch of bands, you know, from touring all over, and I really, really wanted to be in a fast grindcore band, and we got close with a band from Florida called Reversal Man, and they kind of ended up breaking up and kind of morphing in with this other band called Combat from the Veteran. So right as Throatus broke up, I had been talking to them about recording some songs with them, so I went directly into Combat from the Veteran from Throatus. And, first broke up in, December 28th, 1989. And then I was in Florida in early February recording AP with Combat.
And, I've looked through your credits. Your credits are just insane. You know,
what do you mean?
You played with a lot of bands and recorded a lot of music since Throatus. I mean, it seems like you have just, you know, been constantly playing and recording.
I mean, Throatus was, you know, we were active and we liked it. We wrote songs pretty quickly, my argument was like, look, you know, we don't know what's happening with my girlfriend. Like, let's take a 6-month break and then see what's up. And instead of just like totally ending the band. And then, you know, the other guys disagreed with that and they were like, you know, let's just end it. Like, we're tired of doing this. I was like, okay, you know, whatever. Like, you know, I've got no say. But I was still, you know, I still wanted to be in a band. Like, I was not at the point of being like, okay, I give up. I'm not going to be in a band anymore, you know? And at the time, I could, you know, we could kind of sense that things were kind of going away, but not, I never thought it would be over, honestly, you know? It's like one of those things, like, you know, yeah, things are kind of rough, but we'll deal with it. We'll get through it. And my girlfriend was getting treatment in Boston at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and the band Converge had lost their drummer. And so there was a discussion about if I wanted to be in Converge, and because they were writing that record Team Zero. And like, I remember very specifically, I was in every visit, every doctor's appointment for when my girlfriend was sick, every single one of them. And these visits at Dana-Farber would take forever. They take hours. And so she'd go get treatment and scans and all kinds of stuff. And so I was like, hey, let me jump out. I had to go talk to the guys from Converge. And she had, you know, met all these people at the stage. She's like, okay, you know, I'll be here. And I remember being on the phone when it was with the guitarist Kurt and singer Jake, and I was just like, look, you know, if my girlfriend passes away, I'm sure I'll be able to do this. And if she doesn't, I have no idea. And they were just like, that is the most insane. Like, that is way too heavy for us to deal with. I was like, I agree. I was like, I'm just letting you know.
Yeah, too, that's the reality of your life and your situation.
Yeah, you know, and so it was just one of those things, man, you know, like, I didn't know, and like, and so, you know, pro this ends, and then I ended up joining combat when I was a veteran, and people would ask me to play drums on tour, and I would never want to do it. I did play drums on one tour. I went on tour with Good Clean Fire, and we toured the Holy Land. We did England and Israel and England and the UK, and that was right after this as well. And then, like, you know, like, 6 months later, literally 6 months later, Shelby called and asked if I'd want to practice. And I was like, I was enraged. I was like, what do you mean, do I want to practice? And I was like, dude, you don't want to play music. He said, well, I think I'm ready. I was like, so you would want to do the six-month break that I suggested? Like, what the hell? I said, no. You know? And then there's no, you know. And it took a little bit. And then he and I started jamming. Like, and then I started traveling all over the world. And then he and I started jamming again. And that's what then turned into the Black Sea and Decahedron. That was like Throat is Take Two.
But, I mean, something different.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was like, you know, it was Frodis with the bass player from Fugazi. Like, we can't call that Frodis. Like, this is something else. This is absolutely insane. Like, let's figure a different band name. And, you know, like, that's kind of like a more... I mean, it sounds pretty similar to Frodis. It's just a little bit more of a different. You know, it's clearly a different time and place.
And your penetrate self would have been really mad at you.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, you know, it's anytime you're exposed to, and like for me, when I'm exposed to a new idea, or to a new music. It takes me a little bit. And it took me, I will never forget, I was at the used record store in Florida, and I bought 3 7-inches because I thought they looked cool. One was Mudhoney. Two was Rites of Spring. Three was Nirvana. Nirvana Slivers, like this clear-colored 7-inch. It was a Sun Pop 7-inch. Bought all three, returned all three. I was like, I don't like any of these. This is all terrible. And the guy just thought it was hilarious. I was like, I don't get this. I was like, can I get the Judge and Inside Out record instead? And it was just, you know, like time and place, like where you're at. And so it's taken me, you know, it took me a while to kind of appreciate and understand where all that stuff is, you know, where the mid-era DC was coming from. And, of course, I love it to death.
So I would be remiss if I wasn't to ask you about some of the stuff you're doing musically now with music preservation in Syria.
Oh, yeah.
And 'cause that seems to be a complete left turn.
Wait, hold on. I was just doing an illegal U-turn in front of the cops, and this police officer was just staring at me and said, hey, I need to get by. And graciously, this woman just pointed to the no U-turn sign and just told me to keep driving.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
That's funny.
What about the Syria stuff?
I was just saying, it seems completely, like, abstract, and it seems completely something different, but I would love to hear.
I mean, it is, but it isn't, because it's every skill that I learned booking tours. Like, I have to cold call in. Like, I've been working on that for, like, 13 years now, but it's, like, all these different things, all these, like, kind of figuring out going to exotic places. And this is like a complete simplified version of or explanation of this. But that's like the excitement of trying to pull something off, of like going to somewhere new and exciting. It's still music related. It's culture related. There's a lot to be done around it, you know? Like, I don't know. Yes, it's definitely not being in a band, but it's also a lot of the same infrastructure around being in a band is similar to this kind of larger scale Syria project. Without load in. Without having to write my drums, that's a bunch of stairs.
Well, so how did you get into this?
I mean, Decahedron broke up. And then the next night, I was just like, man, I want to do something that's completely different than what I'm normally doing. And the idea was to form an orchestra, like to form a rock, for lack of a better term, and score music. And so I kind of stumbled into it that way. And that's like a highly simplified version of what happened.
The Syrian culture?
Oh, no. So the actual moment really started. And I was driving and I had bad cell phone coverage, and my friend Bill was like, yo, man, I found these rad chains from Serbia. And I was like, man, I never got to go to Syria. That sounds amazing. He's like, no, Serbia. I was like, I know. I was so close on that Good Clean Fun tour. and I just misheard him, honestly. I just misheard him, and it sparked all these memories of all these other, of this book I had read, where this guy allegedly has found the world's oldest Christian music in a church. Or I remembered it wrong, like in a monastery in the desert of Syria. And I was like, dude, I'm going to go find that stuff. And, you know, 13 years later, like, I recorded it in partnership with the Smithsonian Institute. And just this week, this is really exciting. You know that band Sleep?
Yeah.
So the original guitarist of Sleep and I are actually finally scoring the chant. I sent them stuff earlier this week, and so we're actually going to write some music for these chants that I ended up recording.
That's awesome.
I'm so psyched.
Well, so how did you record them?
Well, let's do this, dude. Let's start, too. I'm walking into a meeting in 5 minutes.
All right, because it does seem like
One, we're going way afield of Northern Virginia, and two, this is fascinating, and I would love to hear more about this.
Yeah, like, I mean, when you're like, yeah, let's talk for an hour, I was like, there's no possible way we're going to talk for an hour. I was like, I've never done an hour interview ever.
I got so far and turned it into an hour first episode, for sure.
All right, good.